autonomy meant only that we Japanese now had to oversee our own labor in place of the Russians who had once done it. Discontent, of course, only blossomed among the prisoners of war. Where we had once had a little society that shared its sufferings equally, a sense of unfairness grew, and with it deep hatred and suspicion. Those who served Boris were given lighter duties and special privileges, while those who did not had to live a harsh life, if allowed to live at all. No one could raise his voice in complaint, for open resistance meant death. One might be thrown into an icy shed to die of cold and starvation, or have a wet towel pressed over one's face while asleep, or have the back of one's skull split open with a pick while working in the mine. Down there, you could end up at the bottom of a shaft. Nobody knew what went on in the darkness of the mine. People would just disappear. I couldn't help feeling responsible for having brought Boris and the Colonel together. Of course, if I hadn't become involved, Boris would have borrowed his way in among us sooner or later by some other route with similar results. But such thoughts did little to ease my pain. I had made a terrible mistake. One day I was summoned to the building that Boris used as his office. I had not seen him for a very long time. He sat at a desk, drinking tea, as he had been doing the time I saw him in the station master's office. Behind him, standing to attention with a large caliber automatic pistol in his belt, was the Tatar. When I entered the room, Boris turned around to the Mongolian and signaled for him to leave. The two of us were alone together. "So then, Lieutenant Mamiya, I have kept my promise, you see?" "Indeed he had," I replied. "What he said was unfortunately true. Everything he had promised me had come to pass. It was like a pact with the devil."
"You have your autonomy, and I have my power,"
he said with a smile, holding his arms out wide.
"We both got what we wanted. Coal production has increased, and Moscow is happy. Who could ask for anything more? I am very grateful to you for having acted as my mediator, and I would like to do something for you in return."
"There was no such need," I replied. "Nor is there any need for you to be so distant, Lieutenant. The two of us go way back," said Boris, smiling.
"I want you to work here with me. I want you to be my assistant. Unfortunately, this place has a critical shortage of men who can think. You may be missing a hand, but I can see that your sharp mind more than makes up for it. If you will work as my secretary, I would be most grateful and will do everything I can to see that you have as easy a time of it here as possible. That way, you will be sure to survive and make your way back to Japan. Working closely with me can only do you good."
Ordinarily, I would have rejected such an offer out of hand. I had no intention of selling out my comrades and securing an easy time of it for myself by working as Boris's assistant. And if turning him down meant that he would have me killed, that would have suited me fine. But the moment he presented his offer, I found a plan forming in my mind. "What kind of work do you want me to do?" I asked. What Boris had in mind for me was not a simple task. The number of chores waiting to be taken care of was huge, the single biggest job being the management of Boris's personal assets. Boris had been helping himself to a good 40% of the foodstuffs, clothing, and medical supplies being sent to the camp by Moscow and the International Red Cross, stashing them in secret storehouses and selling them to various takers. He had also been sending off whole trainloads of coal through the black market. There was a chronic shortage of fuel, the demand for it endless. He would bribe railroad workers and the station master, moving trains almost at will for his own profit. Food and money could make the soldiers guarding the trains shut their eyes to what he was doing. Thanks to such business methods, Boris had amassed an amazing fortune. He explained to me that it was ultimately intended as operating capital for the secret police. Our activity, as he called it, required huge sums off the public record, and he was now engaged in procuring those secret funds. But this was a lie. Some of the money may have been finding its way to Moscow, but I was certain that well over half was being transformed into Boris's own personal fortune. As far as I could tell, he was sending the money to foreign bank accounts and buying gold. For some inexplicable reason, he appeared to have complete faith in me. It seems not to have occurred to him that I might leak his secrets to the outside, which I now find very strange. He always treated his fellow Russians and other white men with the utmost suspicion. But towards Mongolians or Japanese, he seemed to feel only the most open-handed trust. Perhaps he assumed that I could do him no harm even if I chose to reveal his secrets. First of all, whom could I reveal them to? Everyone around me was his collaborator or his underling, each with his own tiny share in Boris's huge illegal profits, and the only ones who suffered and died because Boris was diverting their food, clothing, and medicine for his own personal gain were the powerless inmates of the camp. Besides, all mail was censored, and all contact with outsiders was prohibited. And so I became Boris's energetic and faithful private secretary. I completely overhauled his chaotic books and stock records, systemizing and clarifying the flow of goods and money. I created characterized ledgers that showed at a glance the amount and location of any one item and how its price was fluctuating. I compiled a long list of bribe takers and calculated the necessary expenses for each. I worked hard for Boris from morning to night, as a result of which I lost the few friends I had. People thought of me, could not help but think of me, as a despicable human being, a man who had sold out to become Boris's faithful bootlegger. And sadly enough, they probably still think of me that way. Nikolai would no longer speak to me. The two or three other Japanese prisoners of war I had been close to would now turn away when they saw me coming. On the other hand, there were some who tried to approach me when they saw that I had become a favorite of Boris. But I would have nothing to do with them. Thus I became an isolated figure in the camp. Only the support of Boris kept me from being killed. No one could have got away with murdering one of his most prized possessions. People knew how cruel Boris could be. His fame as the man-skinner had reached legendary proportions even here. The more isolated I became, the more Boris came to trust me. He was happy with my efficient, systematic work habits, and he was not stinting in his praise. "You are a very impressive man, Lieutenant Mamiya. Japan will be sure to recover from her post-war chaos as long as there are Japanese like you. My own country is hopeless. It was almost better under the Tsars. At least the Tsar didn't have to strain his empty head over a lot of theory. Lenin took whatever he could understand of Marxist theory and used it to his own advantage, and Stalin took whatever he could understand of Lenin's theory, which wasn't much, and used it to his own advantage. The narrower a man's intellectual grasp, the more power he is able to grab in this country. I tell you, Lieutenant, there is only one way to survive here, and that is not to imagine anything. A Russian who uses his imagination is done for. I certainly never use mine. My job is to make others use their imaginations. That's my bread and butter. Make sure you keep that in mind.
As long as you are in here, at least, picture my face if you ever start to imagine something and say to yourself, no, don't do that. Imagining things can be fatal. These are my golden words of advice to you. Leave the imagining to someone else.
Half a year slipped by like this. Now the autumn of 1947 was drawing to a close, and I had become indispensable to Boris. I was in charge of the business side of his activities, while the Tata was in charge of the violent side. The secret police had yet to summon Boris back to Moscow, but by then he no longer seemed to want to go back. He had more or less transformed the camp and the mine into his own inviolable territory. And there he lived, in comfort, steadily amassing a huge fortune, protected by his own private army. Perhaps, too, rather than bring him back to the center, the Moscow elite preferred to keep him there, firming their foothold in Siberia. The continual exchange of letters passed between Boris and Moscow, not using the post office, of course. They would arrive on the train in the hands of secret messengers. These were always tall men with ice-cold eyes. The temperature in a room seemed to drop whenever one of them walked in. Meanwhile, the prisoners working the mine continued to die in large numbers, their corpses thrown into mine shafts as before. Boris did a thoroughgoing assessment of each prisoner's potential, driving the physically weak ones hard and reducing their food rations at the outset so as to kill them off and reduce the number of mouths he had to feed. The food diverted from the weak went to the strong in order to raise productivity. Efficiency was everything in the camp. It was the law of the jungle, the survival of the fittest. And whenever the workforce began to dwindle, freight cars would arrive packed with new convicts, like trainloads of cattle. Sometimes as much as 20% of the shipment would die on the way, but that was of no concern to anyone. Most of the new convicts were Russians and Eastern Europeans brought in from the West. Fortunately for Boris, Stalin's politics of violence continued to function there. My plan was to kill Boris. I knew, of course, that getting rid of this one man was no guarantee that our situation would improve in any way. It would continue to be one form of hell or another. But I simply could not allow the man to go on living in this world. As Nikolai had said, he was like a poisonous snake. Someone would have to cut his head off. I was not afraid to die. If anything, I would have liked Boris to kill me as I killed him. But there could be no room for error. I had to wait for the one precise moment when I could have absolute confidence that I would kill him without fail. When I could end his life with a single shot, I continued to act the part of his loyal secretary as I waited for the chance to spring on my prey. But as I said earlier, Boris was an extremely cautious man. He kept the Tatar by his side day and night, and even if he should give me a chance to get him alone sometime, how was I to kill him? With my one hand and no weapon. Still I kept my vigil, waiting for the right moment. If there was a god anywhere in this world, I believed the chance would come my way. Early in 1948, a rumor spread through camp that the Japanese prisoners of war were finally going to be allowed to go home, that a ship would be sent to repatriate us in the spring. I asked Boris about it. It is true, Lieutenant Mamiya, he said. The rumor is true. You will all be repatriated before very long. Thanks in part to world opinion, we will not be able to keep you working much longer. But I have a proposition for you, Lieutenant. How would you like to stay in this country, not as a prisoner of war, but as a free Soviet citizen?
You have served me well, and it will be very difficult for me to find a replacement for you. And you, for your part, will have a far more pleasant time of it if you stay with me than if you go back to endure hardship and poverty in Japan. They have nothing to eat, I am told. People are starving to death. Here you would have money, women, power, everything.
Boris made this proposal in all seriousness. He was aware that it could be dangerous to let me go, knowing his secrets as I did. If I turned him down, he might rub me out to keep me from talking. But I was not afraid. I thanked him for his kind offer, but said that I preferred to return to Japan, being concerned about my parents and sister. Boris shrugged once and said nothing further. The perfect chance to kill him presented itself to me one night in March, as the day of repatriation was drawing near. The Tartar had gone out, leaving me alone with Boris just before 9 o'clock at night. I was working on the books, as always, and Boris was at his desk writing a letter. It was unusual for us to be in the office so late. He sipped a brandy now and then as he traced his fountain pen over the paper. On the coat rack hung Boris's leather coat, his hat, and his pistol in a leather holster. The pistol was not the typical Soviet Army issue monster, but a German-made Walther PPK. Boris was supposed to have taken it from a Nazi SS lieutenant colonel captured at the Battle of the Danube Crossing. It had the Lightning SS mark on the handle, and it was always clean and polished. I had often observed Boris working on the gun, and I knew that he kept it loaded with 8 shells in the magazine. For him to have left the gun on the coat rack was most unusual. He was careful to have it close at hand whenever he was working, concealed in the drawer of the right-hand wing of his desk. That night, however, he had been in a very good, very talkative mood for some reason, and because of that, perhaps he had not exercised his usual caution. It was the kind of chance I could never hope for again. Any number of times I had rehearsed in my mind how, with my one hand, I would release the safety catch and send the first cartridge into the chamber. Now, making my decision, I stood and walked past the coat rack pretending to go for a form. Involved in his letter writing, Boris did not look my way. As I passed by, I slipped the gun out of the holster. Its small size fit my palm perfectly, its outstanding workmanship obvious from its weight and balance. I stood before Boris and released the safety. Then, holding the pistol between my knees, I pulled the slide with my right hand, sending a cartridge into the chamber. With my thumb, I pulled the hammer back. When he heard the small, dry sound it made, Boris looked up to find me aiming the gun at his face. He shook his head and sighed. "Too bad for you, Lieutenant, but the gun isn't loaded," he said after clicking the cap of his fountain pen into place.
"You can tell by the weight. Give it a little shake up and down. 8 7.65 millimeter cartridges weigh 80 grams.
I didn't believe him. Without hesitation, I pointed the muzzle at his forehead and pulled the trigger. The only sound was a click. He was right. It wasn't loaded. I put the gun down and bit my lip, unable to think. Boris opened the desk drawer and took out a handful of shells, holding them on his palm for me to see. He had trapped me. The whole thing had been a ruse.
"I have known for a long time that you wanted to kill me,"
he said softly.
"You have imagined yourself doing it, pictured it in your head any number of times, am I right?
I am certain I advised you long ago never to use any imagination. It can only cost you your life. Ah, well, never mind. There is simply no way that you could ever kill me. Varys took two of the shells from his palm and threw them at my feet. They clattered across the floor to where I stood.
"Those are life shells,"
he said. "This is no trick.
Put them in the gun and shoot me. It will be your last chance. If you really want to kill me, take careful aim. But if you miss, you must promise never to reveal my secrets. You must tell no one in the world what I have been doing here. This will be our little deal."
I nodded to him. I made my promise. Holding the pistol between my knees again, I pressed the release button, took out the magazine, and loaded the two cartridges into it. This was no easy feat with one hand, a hand that was trembling all the while. Varys observed my movements with a cool expression on his face. There was even the hint of a smile there. Once I had succeeded in thrusting the magazine back into the grip, I took aim between his eyes, forced my hand to stop trembling, and pulled the trigger. The room shook with the roar of the gun, but the bullet passed by Varys's ear and slammed into the wall. White, pulverized plaster flew in all directions. I had missed from only 6 feet away. I was not a poor marksman. When stationed in Xinjiang, I had done my target practice with a great deal of enthusiasm, and although I had only my right hand now, it was stronger than that of most people, and the Walther was the kind of well-balanced pistol that let you take precise, steady aim. I could not believe that I had missed. Once again I cocked the hammer and took aim. I sucked in one deep breath and told myself, "You have to kill this man. By killing him I could make it mean something that I had lived."
"Take steady aim now, Lieutenant Mamiya. It's your last bullet."
Varys was still smiling. At that moment the Tatar came running into the room, his big pistol drawn.
"Keep out of this!"
Varys barked at him.
"Let Mamiya shoot me, and if he manages to kill me, do whatever you like."
The Tatar nodded and pointed the muzzle of his gun at me. Gripping the Walther in my right hand, I thrust it straight out, aimed for the middle of Varys's contemptuous, confident smile, and coolly squeezed the trigger. The pistol kicked, but I held it steady. It was a perfectly executed shot, but again the bullet grazed Varys's head, this time smashing the wall clock behind him into a million pieces. Varys never so much as twitched an eyebrow. Leaning back in his chair, he went on staring at me with his snake-like eyes. The pistol crashed to the floor. For a moment no one moved or spoke. Soon, though, Varys left his chair and bent over to retrieve the Walther from where I had dropped it. After a long, thoughtful look at the pistol in his hand, he returned it to his holster on the coat rack. Then he patted my arm twice, as if to comfort me. "I told you you couldn't kill me, didn't I?" Varys said. He took a pack of Camels from his pocket, put a cigarette between his lips and lit it with his lighter.
"There was nothing wrong with your shooting. It was just that you couldn't kill me. You weren't qualified to kill me. That is the only reason you missed your chance. And now, unfortunately, you will have to bear my curse back to your homeland. Listen, wherever you may be, you can never be happy. You will never love anyone or be loved by anyone. That is my curse. I will not kill you, but I do not spare you out of goodwill. I have killed many people over the years, and I will go on to kill many more. But I never kill anyone whom there is no need to kill.
Goodbye, Lieutenant Mamiya. A week from now, you will leave this place for the port of Nakhodka.
Bon voyage. The two of us will never meet again.
That was the last I ever saw of Boris the Man Skinner. The week after that, I left the concentration camp behind and was shipped by train to Nakhodka. After many torturous experiences there, I finally reached Japan at the beginning of the following year. To tell you the truth, I have no idea what this long, strange story of mine will mean to you, Mr. Okada. Perhaps it is nothing more than an old man's mutterings. But I wanted to, I had to, tell you my story. As you can see from having read my letter, I have lived my life in total defeat. I have lost. I am lost. I am qualified for nothing. Through the power of the curse, I love no one, and am loved by no one. A walking shell. I will simply disappear into darkness. Having managed at long last, however, to pass my story on to you, Mr. Okada, I will be able to disappear with some small degree of contentment. May the life you lead be a good one, a life free of regrets.
33. A dangerous place. The people watching television. The Hollow Man. The door began to open. Holding the tray in both hands, the waiter gave a slight bow and went inside. I stayed in the shadows of the vase, waiting for him to come out and wondering what I would do when he did. I could go in as he came out. There was definitely someone inside room 208. If things continued to develop as they had done before, which was just what was happening, the door should be unlocked. On the other hand, I could forget about the room for now and follow the waiter. That way I could probably find my way to the place where he belonged. I wavered between the two, but in the end I decided to follow the waiter. There was something dangerous lurking in room 208, something that could have fatal consequences. I had all too clear a memory of the sharp rapping in the darkness and the violent white gleam of some knife-like thing. I had to be more careful. Let me first see where the waiter would lead me. Then I could come back to the room. But how was I supposed to do that? I thrust my hands into my pockets and found there, along with my wallet and change and handkerchief, a small ballpoint pen. I pulled the pen out and drew a line on my hand to make sure it had ink. I could use this to mark the walls as I followed the waiter. Then I could follow the marks back to the room. It should work. The door opened, and the waiter came out, empty-handed. He had left everything inside the room, including the tray. After closing the door, he straightened himself and began whistling The Thieving Magpie as he hurried back along the route he had followed here. I stepped out from my place in the shadow of the big vase and followed him. Wherever the corridor forked, I made a small blue X on the cream-colored wall. The waiter never looked back. There was something special about the way he walked. He could have been an entrant in the World Hotel Waiter Walking Style Championship. His walk all but proclaimed, "This is how a hotel waiter is supposed to walk, head up, jaw thrust out, back straight, arms swinging rhythmically to the tune of The Thieving Magpie, taking long strides down the corridor." He turned many corners, went up and down many short flights of stairs, along stretches where the lighting was brighter or dimmer, past depressions in the walls that produced different kinds of shadows. I maintained a reasonable distance behind him to keep from being noticed, but following him was not particularly difficult. He might disappear for a moment as he turned a corner, but there was never any danger of my losing him, thanks to his vibrant whistling. Just as a salmon migrating upstream eventually reaches a still pool, the waiter came out of the final corridor into the hotel lobby. The crowded lobby, where I had seen Noboru Wataya on television. This time, however, the lobby was hushed, with only a handful of people sitting in front of a large television set, watching an NHK news broadcast. The waiter had stopped whistling as he neared the lobby, so as not to disturb people. Now he cut straight across the lobby floor and disappeared behind a door marked Staff Only. Pretending to be killing time, I ambled around the lobby, sat on a few different sofas, looked up at the ceiling, checked the thickness of the rug beneath my feet. Then I went to a payphone and put in a coin. This phone was as dead as the one in the room had been. I picked up a hotel phone and punched in 208, but this phone was also dead. After that, I went to sit in a chair away from where the people were watching television to observe them unobtrusively. The group consisted of 12 people, 9 men and 3 women, mostly in their 30s and 40s, with 2 possibly in their early 50s. The men all wore suits or sports coats and conservative ties and leather shoes. Apart from some differences in height and weight, none had any distinguishing features. The 3 women were all in their early 30s, well-dressed and carefully made up. They could have been on their way back from a school reunion, except that they sat separately and gave no indication of knowing each other. In fact, all the people in the group appeared to be strangers whose attention just happened to be locked on the same television screen. There were no exchanges of opinions or glances or nods. I sat watching the news for a while from my place. The stories were of no special interest to me. A governor cutting a tape at the opening ceremony for a new road, children's crayons that had been discovered to contain a harmful substance, the death of a truck driver who had been hit by a tourist bus in Asaikawa because of icy roads and reduced visibility in a major snowstorm, with injuries to several of the tourists on their way to a hot spring resort. The announcer read each of the stories in turn in a restrained voice, as though dealing out low-numbered cards. I thought about the television in the home of Mr. Honda, the fortune-teller. His set had always been tuned to NHK, too. These images of the news coming over the air were at the same time very real and very unreal to me. I felt sorry for the 37-year-old truck driver who had died in the accident. No one wants to die in an agony of ruptured internal organs in a blizzard in Asaikawa. But I was not acquainted with the truck driver, and he did not know me, and so my sympathy for him had nothing personal about it. I could feel only a generalized kind of sympathy for a fellow human being who had met with a sudden violent death. That generalized emotion might be very real for me, and at the same time not real at all. I turned my eyes from the television screen and surveyed the big, empty lobby once more. I found nothing there to focus on. There were no hotel staff members, and the small bar was not yet open. The only thing on the wall was a large oil painting of a mountain. When I turned back to the television screen, there was a large close-up of a familiar face. Noboru Wataya's face. I sat up straight and turned my attention to the reporter's words. Something had happened to Noboru Wataya, but I had missed the beginning of the story. Soon, the photo disappeared and the reporter appeared on screen. He wore a tie and an overcoat, and he was standing in the entrance to a large building with a mic in his hand. "Rushed to Tokyo Women's Medical University Hospital, where he is now in intensive care, but all we know is that he has not regained consciousness since his skull was fractured by an unknown assailant. Hospital authorities have refused to comment on whether or not his wounds are life-threatening. A detailed report on his condition is to be released later. Reporting from the main entrance of Tokyo Women's Medical University." And the broadcast returned to the studio, where the anchorman began to read a text that had just been handed to him.
"According to reports just in, Representative Noboru Wataya has sustained severe injuries to the head in what appears to have been an attack on his life. The young assailant burst into his office in Tokyo's Minato district at 11:30 this morning and, in the presence of the persons whom Representative Wataya was meeting at the time, delivered several strong blows to the head with a baseball bat, inflicting severe injuries."
The screen showed a picture of the building that housed Noboru Wataya's office.
"The man had posed as a caller to Representative Wataya's office, concealing the bat inside a long cardboard mailing tube. Witnesses say the man pulled the bat out of the tube and attacked without a word of warning."
The screen showed the office where the crime had occurred. Chairs were scattered on the floor, and a black pool of blood could be seen nearby.
The attack came so suddenly that neither Representative Wataya nor the others with him had a chance to resist. After checking to be certain that Representative Wataya was unconscious, the assailant left the scene, still holding the baseball bat. Witnesses say the man, approximately 30 years of age, was wearing a navy blue coat, a woolen ski hat, also navy, and dark glasses. He was about 5'9" and had a bruise-like mark on his right cheek. Police are looking for the man who seems to have managed to lose himself without a trace in the crowds.
The screen showed police at the scene of the crime and then a lively Akasaka street scene. Baseball bat? Mark on the face? I bit my lip.
Noboru Wataya was a rising star among economists and political commentators when this spring he inherited the mantle of his uncle, longtime Diet member Yoshitaka Wataya, and was elected to the House of Representatives. Widely hailed since then as an influential young politician and polemicist, Noboru Wataya was someone of whom much was expected. Police are launching a two-pronged investigation into the crime, assuming that it could have been either politically motivated or some kind of personal vendetta. To repeat this late-breaking story, Noboru Wataya, prominent member of the House of Representatives, has been rushed to the hospital with severe head injuries after an attack late this morning by an unknown assailant. Details on his condition are not known at this time. And now, in other news.
Someone appeared to have switched off the television at that point. The announcer's voice was cut short, and silence enveloped the lobby. People began to relax their tensed postures. It was obvious that they had gathered in front of the television for the express purpose of hearing news about Noboru Wataya. No one moved after the set was switched off. No one made a sound. Who could have hit Noboru Wataya with a bat? The description of the assailant sounded exactly like me. The navy coat and hat, the sunglasses, the mark on the cheek, height, age, and the baseball bat. I had kept my own bat in the bottom of the well for months, but it had disappeared. If the same bat was the one used to crush Noboru Wataya's skull, then someone must have taken it for that purpose. Just then, the eyes of one of the women in the group focused on me. A skinny, fish-like woman with prominent cheekbones. She wore white earrings in the very center of her long earlobes. She had twisted around in her chair and sat in that position for a long time, watching me, never averting her gaze or changing her expression. Next, the bald man sitting beside her, letting his eyes follow her line of vision, turned and looked at me. In height and build, he resembled the owner of the cleaning store by the station. One by one, the other people turned in my direction, as if becoming aware for the first time that I was there with them. Subjected to their unwavering stares, I could not help but be aware of my navy blue jacket and hat, my 5'9" height, my age, and the mark on my right cheek. These people all seemed to know, too, that I was Noboru Wataya's brother-in-law, and that I not only disliked but actively hated him. I could see it in their eyes. My grip tightened on the arm of my chair as I wondered what to do. I had not beaten Noboru Wataya with a baseball bat. I was not that kind of person, and besides, I no longer owned the bat. But they would never believe me, I was sure. They believed only what they saw on television. I eased out of my chair and started for the corridor by which I had entered the lobby. I had to leave that place as soon as possible. I was not welcome there. I'd only taken a few steps when I turned to see that several of the people had left their chairs and were coming after me. I sped up and cut straight across the lobby for the corridor. I had to find my way back to room 208. The inside of my mouth was dry. I had finally made it across the lobby and taken my first step into the corridor when, without a sound, all the lights in the hotel went out. A heavy curtain of blackness fell with the speed of an axe blow. Someone cried out behind me, the voice much closer than I would have expected, a stony hatred at its core. I continued on in the darkness, edging forward cautiously with my hands against the wall. I had to get away from them. But then I bumped into a small table and knocked something over in the darkness, probably some kind of vase. It rolled, clattering, across the floor. The collision sent me down on all fours on the carpet.
I scrambled to my feet and continued feeling my way along the corridor. Just then, the edge of my coat received a sharp yank, as if it had caught on a nail. It took me a moment to realize what was happening. Someone was pulling on my coat. Without hesitation, I slipped out of it and lunged ahead in the darkness. I felt my way around a corner, tripped up a staircase, and turned another corner, my head and shoulders bumping into things all the while. At one point, I missed my footing on a step and smashed my face against the wall. I felt no pain, though, only a dull twinge behind the eyes. I couldn't let them catch me here. There was no light of any kind, not even the emergency lighting that was supposed to come on in hotels in case of a power failure. After tearing my way through this featureless darkness, I came to a halt, trying to catch my breath, and listened for sounds behind me. All I could hear, though, was the wild beating of my own heart. I knelt down for a moment's rest. They must have given up the chase. If I went any further in the darkness now, I would probably end up lost in the depths of the labyrinth. I decided to stay here, leaning against the wall, and try to calm myself. Who could have turned out the lights? I couldn't believe it had been a coincidence. It had happened the very moment I stepped into the corridor as people were catching up with me. Most likely someone there had done it to rescue me from danger. I took my wool hat off, wiped the sweat from my face with my handkerchief, and put the hat back on. I was beginning to notice pain in different parts of my body, but I didn't seem to have any injuries as such. I looked at the luminous hands of my watch in the darkness, only to remember that the watch had stopped at 11:30. That was the time I climbed down into the well, and it was also the time that someone had beaten Noboru Wataya in his office with a baseball bat. Could I have been the one who did it? Down here, in the darkness like this, that began to seem like one more theoretical possibility. Perhaps up there, in the real world, I had struck him with the bat and injured him severely, and I was the only one who didn't know about it. Perhaps the intense hatred inside me had taken the initiative to walk over there without my knowing it and administer him a drubbing. Did I say walk? I would have had to take the Odakyu line to Shinjuku and change there to the subway in order to get to Akasaka. Could I have done such a thing without being aware of it? No, certainly not. Unless there existed another me.
Mr. Okada,
someone said close by in the darkness. My heart leaped into my throat. I had no idea where the voice had come from. My muscles tensed as I scanned the darkness, but of course I could see nothing.
Mr. Okada,
the voice came again, a man's low voice.
Don't worry, Mr. Okada. I'm on your side. We met here once before, don't you remember?
I did remember. I knew that voice. It belonged to the man with no face. But I had to be careful. I was not ready to answer.
You have to leave this place as soon as possible, Mr. Okada. They'll come to find you when the lights come on. Follow me. I know a shortcut.
The man switched on a pen light. It cast a small beam, but it was enough to show me where to step.
This way,
the man urged. I scrambled up from the floor and hurried after him.
You must be the one who turned out the lights for me, is that right?
I asked the man from behind. He did not answer, but neither did he deny it.
Thanks, I said. It was a close call.
They are very dangerous people, he said. Much more dangerous than you think.
I asked him, was Noboru Wataya really injured in some kind of beating?
That is what they said on TV,
the man replied, choosing his words carefully.
I didn't do it, though, I said. I was down a well at the time, alone.
If you say so, I'm sure you are right,
the man said matter-of-factly. He opened a door, and shining the torch on his feet, he began edging his way up the flight of stairs on the other side. It was such a long staircase that halfway through the process, I lost track of whether we were climbing or descending. I was not even sure this was a staircase.
Is there anyone who can swear that you were in the well at the time?
The man asked, without turning around.
I said nothing. There was no such person.
In that case, the wisest thing would be for you to run away. They have decided for themselves that you are the culprit.
Who are they? Reaching the top of the stairs, the man turned right, and after a short walk, opened a door and stepped out into a corridor. There he stopped to listen for sounds.
We have to hurry. Hold on to my jacket.
I grasped the bottom edge of his jacket as ordered. The man with no face said,
Those people are always glued to the television set. That is why you are so greatly disliked here. They are very fond of your wife's elder brother.
Do you know who I am? I asked.
Yes, of course I do.
So then, do you know where Kumiko is now? The man said nothing. I kept a firm grip on the tail of the man's coat, as if we were playing some kind of game in the dark, rushing around another corner, down a short staircase, through a small secret door, through a low-ceilinged hidden passageway, into yet another corridor. The strange, intricate route taken by the faceless man felt like an endless journey through the bowels of a huge bronze figure.
Let me tell you this, Mr. Okada. I don't know everything that happens here. This is a big place, and my area of responsibility centers on the lobby. There is a lot that I don't know anything about.
Do you know about the whistling waiter?
No, I don't. There are no waiters here, whistling or otherwise. If you saw a waiter in here somewhere, he wasn't really a waiter. It was something pretending to be a waiter. I failed to ask you, but you wanted to go to room 208, is that correct?
That is correct. I'm supposed to meet a certain woman there. The man had nothing to say to that. He pressed for no details about the woman or what my business with her might be. He continued down the corridor with the confident stride of a man who knows his way around, dragging me like a tugboat along a complicated course. Eventually, with no warning, he came to a stop in front of a door. I bumped into him from behind, practically knocking him over. His flesh on impact felt light and airy, as if I had bumped into an empty cicada shell. He quickly straightened himself and used his pocket torch to illuminate the number on the door, 208.
This door is not locked,
said the man.
Take this light with you. I can walk back in the dark. Lock the door when you go in, and don't open it to anyone. Whatever business you have, get it over with quickly and go back where you came from. This place is dangerous. You are an intruder here, and I am the only one on your side. Don't forget that.
Who are you? I asked. The faceless man handed me the torch as if passing a baton.
I am the Hollow Man, he said.
Faceless face towards me, he waited in the darkness for me to speak, but I could not find the right words. Eventually, without a sound, he disappeared. He was right in front of me one second, swallowed up by darkness the next. I shone the light in his direction, but only the dull white wall came out of the darkness. As the man had said, the door to room 208 was unlocked. The knob turned in my hand without a sound. I took the precaution of switching the torch off, then stepped in as quietly as I could. As before, the room was silent, and I could sense nothing moving inside. There was the faint crack of melting ice moving inside the ice bucket. I switched on the torch and turned to lock the door. The dry, metallic tumbling of the lock sounded abnormally loud in the room. On the table in the center stood the unopened bottle of Cutty Sark, clean glasses, and the bucket full of fresh ice. The silver-colored tray beside the vase shot the beam of the torch back with a sensual gleam, as if it had been waiting for me for a very long time. In response, it seemed, the smell of the flower's pollen became stronger for a moment. The air around me grew dense, and the pull of gravity seemed to increase. With my back against the door, I watched the movement around me in the beam of the torch. This place is dangerous. You are an intruder here, and I am the only one on your side. Don't forget that.
Don't shine that light on me,
said a woman's voice in the inner room.
Do you promise not to shine that light on me?
I promise, I said. 34. The light of a firefly. Breaking the spell. A world where alarm clocks ring in the morning. I promise, I said, but my voice had a certain artificial quality, as when you hear a recording of yourself speaking.
I want to hear you say it, but you won't shine your light on me.
I won't shine the light on you, I promise.
Do you really promise? You're telling me the truth?
I'm telling you the truth. I won't break my promise.
All right, then. What I'd really like you to do, if you don't mind, is pour 2 whiskies on the rocks and bring them over here. Lots of ice, please.
She spoke with the slightest hint of a playful, girlish lisp, but the voice itself belonged to a mature, sensual woman. I laid the penlight lengthways on the table, and in its light went about pouring the 2 whiskies, taking a moment first to steady my breathing. I broke the seal on the cutty sark, used tongs to fill the 2 glasses, and poured the whiskey over the ice cubes. I had to think clearly about each task my hands were performing. Large shadows played over the wall with every movement. I walked into the inner room, holding the 2 whiskies in my right hand and lighting my way along the floor with the torch in my left. The air felt chillier than before. I must have worked up a sweat in my rush through the darkness and was now beginning to cool off. I remembered that I had shed my coat along the way. As promised, I turned out the light and slipped it into my pocket. Then, by feel, I placed 1 whiskey on the night table and took my own with me to the armchair by the bed. In total darkness, I nonetheless remembered the layout of the room. I seemed to hear the sliding of sheets against each other. She was raising herself in bed and leaning against the headboard, glass now in hand. She gave the glass a little shake, stirring the ice, and took a sip of whiskey. In the darkness, these were all like sound effects in a radio play. I inhaled the aroma of the whiskey in my hand, but I did not drink. "It's been a long time," I said. My voice sounded somewhat more like my own than it had before.
"Has it?"
she said.
"I'm not sure what that means, time, or a long time."
"As I recall, it's been exactly 1 year and 5 months," I said.
"Well, well,"
she said, unimpressed.
"I can't recall exactly."
I put my glass on the floor and crossed my legs. "You weren't here last time I came, were you?"
"Of course I was. Right here. In bed. I'm always here."
"But I'm sure I was in room 208. This is room 208, isn't it?" She swirled the ice in her glass and gave a little laugh.
"And I'm sure you weren't so sure. You were in another room 208. That's for sure."
There was a certain unsteadiness in her voice which unsettled me. The alcohol might have been affecting her. I took my woolen cap off and laid it on my knee. I said to her, "The phone was dead, you know."
"Yes, I know,"
she said with a hint of resignation.
"They cut it. They knew how I used to like to make calls."
"Are they the ones who are keeping you here?"
"I wonder. I don't really know,"
she said with a little laugh. The disturbance in the air made her voice quaver. Facing in her direction, I said, "I've been thinking about you for a very long time, ever since I was last here, thinking about who you are and what you're doing here."
"Sounds like fun,"
she said. "I imagine all sorts of possibilities, but I can't be sure of anything yet. I'm still at the imagining stage."
"Well, well,"
she said, as if impressed.
"So you can't be sure of anything yet. You're still at the imagining stage."
"That's right," I said. "And I might as well tell you this. I think you're Kumiko. I didn't realize it at first, but I'm becoming more and more convinced."
"Oh, are you?"
she said after a moment's pause, sounding amused.
"So I'm Kumiko, am I?"
For a moment I lost all sense of direction, as if everything I was doing was off the mark. I had come to the wrong place to say the wrong things to the wrong person. It was all a waste of time, a meaningless detour. But I managed to set myself straight in the dark. To perform a check on reality, I fastened my hands on the hat in my lap. "Yes," I think you're Kumiko, because then all kinds of storylines work out. You kept calling me on the phone from here. You were trying to convey some kind of secret to me, a secret of Kumiko's, a secret that the real Kumiko in the real world couldn't bring herself to tell me, so you must have been doing it for her, in words like secret codes. She said nothing for a while. She lifted her glass for another sip of whiskey, then said,
I wonder, but if that's what you think, you may be right. Maybe I really am Kumiko. I'm still not sure, though. So then, if it's true, if I really am Kumiko, I should be able to talk to you here through her voice. Isn't that right? It makes things a little complicated. But do you mind?
No, I don't mind, I said. Once more my voice seemed to have lost a degree of calm and some sense of reality. She cleared her throat in the darkness.
Here goes, then. I wonder if it will work.
Again she gave a little laugh.
It's not easy, though. Are you in a hurry? Can you stay here a while?
I don't really know, I said.
Wait just a minute. Sorry. I'll be ready in a minute.
I waited.
So, you came here looking for me. You wanted to see me. Is that it?
Kumiko's earnest voice resounded in the darkness. I had not heard Kumiko's voice since that summer morning when I zipped her dress up. She had been wearing a new cologne behind the ears, cologne from someone else. She left the house that day and never came back. Whether the voice in the darkness was the real thing or a fake, it brought me back to that morning for a moment. I could smell the cologne and see the white skin of Kumiko's back. The memory was dense and heavy in the darkness, perhaps denser and heavier than in reality. I tightened my grip on my hat. Strictly speaking, I didn't come here to see you. I came here to bring you back, I said. She released a little sigh in the darkness.
Why do you want so badly to bring me back?
Because I love you, I said. And I know that you love me and want me.
You sound pretty sure of yourself,
said Kumiko, or Kumiko's voice. There was nothing derisive about her tone of voice, but nothing warm about it either. I heard the contents of the ice bucket in the next room shifting.
I have to solve some riddles, though, if I'm going to get you back, I said. Isn't it a little late to be starting such things now? I thought you didn't have that much time.
She was right. There was not much time left and too much to think about. I wiped the sweat from my brow at the back of my hand. This was probably my last chance, I told myself. I had to think. I want you to help me, I said.
I wonder, said Kumiko's voice. I may not be able to help you, but I'm willing to try.
The first question is why you had to leave me. I want to know the real reason. I know what your letter said, that you had become involved with another man. I read it, of course, and read it, and read it, and reread it, and I suppose it does offer some kind of explanation, but I can't believe it's the real reason. It doesn't quite ring true. I'm not saying it's a lie, but I can't help feeling it's nothing but a kind of metaphor.
A metaphor?
She sounded truly shocked.
Maybe I just don't get it, but if sleeping with other men is a metaphor for something, I'd like to know what. What I'm trying to say is that it seems to me to be nothing but an explanation for explanation's sake. It doesn't lead anywhere. It just traces the surface. The more I read your letter, the more I felt that. There must be some other reason that is more basic, more real, and it almost certainly involves Noboru Wataya.
I could feel her eyes focused on me in the darkness, and was struck by the thought that she might be able to see me.
"Involves Noboru Wataya? How?"
asked Kumiko's voice.
"Well, the events I've been through have been tremendously complicated. All kinds of characters have come on the scene, and strange things have happened one after another to the point where, if I try to think about them in order, I lose track. Viewed from more of a distance, though, the thread running through them is perfectly clear. What it all boils down to is that you have gone over from my world to the world of Noboru Wataya.
That shift is the important thing. Even if you did, in fact, have sex with another man or other men, that is a secondary matter, a front. That's what I'm trying to say.
She inclined her glass in the darkness, staring hard at the source of the sound. I felt as if I could catch a faint glimpse of her movements, but this was obviously an illusion.
People don't always send messages in order to communicate.